Father has a business, strictly secondhand. Everything from toothpicks to a baby grand.
This hour, Barbara Streisand, redefining beauty, femininity, and power. Neil Gabler has written this beautiful book about the woman who Vanity Fair called the most successful and talented performer of her generation. Popular vocalist, Broadway star, Oscar-winning actress, producer, and director. It's hard to believe now, but she was rejected by her high school chorus, discounted at auditions for being too Jewish, told by her mother she didn't have talent. She refused to be discounted, and what a life she has had.
Second-hand clothes, that's why they call me Second-hand Rose. Even
Neil Gabler is the author of the book that we're talking about this hour, Barbara Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. He's written a lot of other books, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the Imagination, which won the L.A. Times Book Prize. He's also author of Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity, and many other books as well. It's just a really engaging book. I didn't know a whole lot about her early life, which was very, very hard. She just had nobody who had her back, and yet she became this incredible star. So Barbara Streisand is who we talk about. One of her, well, her first film actually was Funny Girl. And these are just two words at the beginning of that film, but they say a whole lot about her. We'll have Neil talk about what they mean after we hear the two words.
Hello, gorgeous.
And Neil, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
It's a wonderful book. It's just so beautifully written as well. Those two words and the way she said them, Jewish Brooklyn, and then we started to see in Funny Girl just a whole lot of incredible talent.
That is true. You know, Pauline Kael, the New Yorker film critic, said of her, and I love this term, she said, Barbara Streisand taught us that talent is beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she said, hello, gorgeous, you know, she was sort of mocking herself on the one hand. But on the other hand, she was also kind of certifying that a woman like this, whom Hollywood had never embraced before Barbara Streisand, there had never been anyone like her, aside from comedians and sidekicks, was indeed gorgeous. And you can look at her career as being the certification of that idea that someone who is as ethnic as Barbara Streisand, as Jewish as Barbara Streisand, as loud as Barbara Streisand, as obnoxious as some people may find Barbara Streisand, could also be considered beautiful. She changed, in some ways, our perception of what beauty meant.
Yeah, she really did. And you also write about the millions of people who were seeing that and hearing her sing. There had never been anybody on her, you write, on the movie screen like her. So millions now had someone of their own, someone who they didn't have to dream of becoming.
Yeah, Kathleen, that's exactly right. You know, because the transaction that we normally have when we go into a movie theater, even today, and certainly true when Barbara Streisand was coming to power in Hollywood, is, you know, we look at somebody and we say, boy, I wish I could be that person. And we have a certain vicarious charge from projecting ourselves onto that personality,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a Julia Roberts or a Tom Cruise or a George Clooney or a Jennifer Lawrence, for that matter. But with Barbara Streisand, the transaction was very different. We didn't feel, I wish I could be like Barbara Streisand. We felt we were Barbara Streisand, and she was us. And that her experiences were experiences that we had had. That her pain, her loneliness, her heartbreak, those were all things that we had endured. And in a way, you could say that Barbara Streisand was, and is, to this day, the entertainer of the marginalized, of the humiliated, of the slighted, of the abused. She's that person who stands for all of us.
And People, the part of the book that deals with her early singing experiences when she was very, very young in New York, the marginalized community, the marginalized gay community understood that about her and saw themselves in her, and she was winning.
You know, I'm not sure that Barbara Streisand would have become a star if it hadn't been for several constituencies. A Jew, certainly,
mm-hmm.
women, certainly,
mm-hmm.
and as you point out, the gay community. She appeared early on at gay clubs, very much like Bette Midler later on. And they found in her a kindred spirit. They knew that she was different, and they had been told that they were different. And there was this attachment that they formed to Barbara Streisand that lasts to this day. You know, she is one of them, and they appreciate her difference, and they appreciate the way in which the conventional rules of culture were flouted by her.
Yes.
As they were flouting those rules.
The early life that you write about, I just didn't know very much about her early life. I was just astounded that there was nobody who was in her corner, and here she was, a five-year-old who could sing beautifully, and the neighbors heard it, but she was taunted. You know, the nose is like a beak. She's Jewish. She's getting anti-Semitic comments. Even her mother, to the day, really, that her mother died, didn't give her any support. She was just on her own.
You know, she didn't have a father because her father died when she was only 15 months old. And that was a yawning gap in her life. As the father of two daughters myself, you know, I realized the role that a father plays in the image formation of a young girl. Well, she didn't have that person to help devise her image as she was growing up. Instead, she had a mother who was deeply resentful of her, and who told her repeatedly that when Barbara expressed her dream that she wanted to be a movie star when she was still a very young girl, her mother said repeatedly, "You're not pretty enough.
Mm.
You're never going to be a movie star. Why don't you lower your sights and become a secretary?" And I think one of the interesting things that Barbara Streisand has said about herself is that her famously long nails were grown, she said, so that she could never type.
And yet she took care of her mom. She had an apartment for her and took care of her sister, who her mother thought was the beautiful one, right?
That's right. Well, her mother remarried, and her mother married the most inappropriately named human being I can imagine. His name was Louis Kine, but he was anything but kind when it came to Barbara. He once said to her, as she remembered it, I can't buy you ice cream because you're too ugly. And he and Barbara's mother did have a daughter of their own, Rosalind Kind, who became a singer in her own right, not anything like Barbara Streisand. But he would say of his two daughters, his own natural-born daughter and a stepdaughter, he would call Rosalind Beauty and Barbara the Beast. So that's the sort of thing that, as a very young girl, Barbara Streisand encountered. And when people later on, you know, kind of reviled her for being a diva and a monster and impossible and the B word, and you know, she did practically invent that B word, some people said, you can see the source for that sort of behavior. She was a woman who had to summon every last bit of energy and confidence and fortitude and whatever to just make it through, much less to become a movie star. I mean, the odds against her,
right,
both in terms of the conventional idea of what a movie star is and in terms of her psychologically and the psychological makeup that she had to summon to get there, the odds were formidable, if not impossible.
Yeah. She goes to New York, I think she's 14, and sees The Diary of Anne Frank, and is so moved by that she auditions for a show that she doesn't get into. But she wants to be a serious actor and trains herself, goes to acting school, very prestigious acting schools in New York. Why didn't she realize that it was the voice that was going to allow her to pay the rent?
You know, singing came very easily for her, and she started singing when she was a very young girl, and it came too easily for her. She was never a trained singer. She never took a singing lesson in her life.
Amazing.
Later on in her life, she said that she never did vocal exercises. You know, she'd sit in the car on the way to the concert, and that would be it. You know, she'd do a couple of runs of scales, and that would be it. So the idea that singing would be her profession seemed to her sort of beneath her. It wasn't hard enough. Acting, on the other hand, was something that she did, as you point out. She had to take lessons. She had to be trained. She felt that this is really art. The singing wasn't art. The singing was just something she did. But acting was art. And she saw singing, when she finally did become a singer, as the means to an end, the end being a Hollywood actress. She wasn't even interested in the stage, frankly. I mean, she took the role in Funny Girl not because she wanted to be a Broadway star. That was the last show she did. She took that role because she wanted to star in the movie version, assuming that the play was a success. Which so, it was, of course.
It sure was. We're going to weave some music in and out. I love her arrangement. Well, let's hear a little bit of this. Yeah. And she used this during the talent show competitions that she sang in New York, which I thought were great stories that you told. The way she sings this is remarkable. So let's listen to just a little bit of Barbra Streisand singing the FDR campaign song, and what she does with this song and how she used it had people early on in New York knowing this woman's got something.
So long, sad times, go long, bad times, we are rid of you.
What she's done with that song just is remarkable to me, Neil. I love that song.
It's pretty amazing.
Oh.
She did that originally on the Gary Moore Show. They had a segment on that show called That Wonderful Year, and they did 1932, the year that FDR was elected president, and that, of course, was his campaign song, not sung that way. And she gave it that rendition of taking a song that was meant to be bouncy and confidence-building, and then turned it into a dirge. And it's just remarkable. But Barbra Streisand had a way of taking songs and turning them around and making them her own.
Mm-hmm.
And very early on, music critics and audiences recognized that gift. She didn't sing like anybody else. She was really, you know, sui generis. She had a way of approaching a song that no one else had. And it was one of the reasons why almost overnight. You know, she was very young when she first started
getting traction in
show business.
Really?
She was a teenager.
I know.
She was a teenager. People don't realize that when she did Funny Girl on Broadway, she was only 22 years old.
Wow.
Only 22 years old. But from almost from the inception, this tells you what a natural she was. She just got it. She got what to do with the song, again, without any training. And that is a perfect example of how she got it, of how she knew what to do with a song, even though she was basically an amateur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was not really, she was just beginning to be a professional singer at that point.
And the way she, each word, it's as though, and she didn't study it, but each word, when she says you, when she says almost every word in this, it just sounds, she just makes the word more than the word is, even if it may be a beautiful word or just a standard kind of word. It's more than a word when she sings it.
That's sort of the magic of Streisand. You know, it's been said that she sang not to the melodic line, but to the meaning of the words. And in that way, she acted every song. What she was interested in is meaning. And because she wanted to be an actress, the only way that she could really tolerate singing, and I do use that word advisedly, tolerate singing, was that she treated each song as if it were an acting performance. Very early on in her career, a friend of hers, who gave her some advice about singing, said to her, think of each song as a three-act play and perform it that way. And she really did approach songs in that fashion of thinking of meaning rather than melody. And she also did something else that you point out, Kathleen, which I think is very interesting if you're looking at Barbara Streisand's technique. There are sounds in the English language that are very ugly sounds. And they actually have a name for them. They're called schwa. And they're usually vowel sounds that are really neither long nor short, like the A in amazing, amazing, or the O in gallop, even when you say them, when you separate them out from the word, they're ugly sounds. And singers don't like singing ugly sounds. And they try different mechanisms to make the sounds sound better. But what Barbara Streisand did is, she found a way to bring those sounds, that schwa sound, which is in the upper part of your vocal cord, and you can even try this at home, experiment with this. It's an eh sound, and it's in the upper vocal cord, but she would bring them up into her soft palate and give them a rounder sound, a more beautiful sound. She would change that sound, as we heard in Happy Days Are Here Again, elongate it and make it sound much more melodious than it actually was, if you were to speak it.
It's quite a sound. Let's take a phone call. We'll hear more music, and we'll continue. We have a lot of movies to get to, and directing, and she just won every award in the business as well. Our guest this hour is the author of a wonderful book about Barbara, and I guess I don't know how I missed this, because I've been a fan of hers for a long time, but I just never noticed that it's B-A-R-B-R-A, not B-A-R-B-A-R-A. I just realized that. Barbara Streisand, we'll talk about why she did that, too. Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. Neil Gabler is our guest. Let's start our calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Facebook page, leave messages there, too, about Barbara Streisand. We'd love to read them and say them on the air, maybe, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Rich in Rhinelander is our first call for you, Neil. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Love the show. And I have to say, I want to hear more about the two Jewish part, because I remember Yentl and the songs, Papa, Can You Hear Me?
Yes.
And The Way He Makes Me Feel. And that was a film in which a young woman is seeking knowledge, and she has to study it secretly, covertly with a real rabbi, and she essentially becomes very learned in Talmudic law. What's really funny about it is I remember her for her singing, but she got Best Director for that film, mm-hmm. At Golden Globes, and I believe she was the first woman that ever won Best Director at the Golden Globes. I just think it's fascinating the way people turn around prejudice, artists turn around prejudice and just stick it in people's eye, because for many Jews, that was not too Jewish a film.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you brought up so many good areas for more exploration. Thanks, Rich, for the call.
Rich really opened up a whole area of discussion. Right. And I think the things he said are absolutely right. In fact, one of the points I make in the book is that Barbara Streisand, who was unmistakably Jewish and who embraced her Jewishness, never denied it, never tried to hide it, who was a star not in spite of her Jewishness, but because of her Jewishness, did something rather remarkable in that she took her Jewishness and turned it into a metaphor for otherness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she knew what it was like to be the other, because she was Jewish and because she was Jewish-looking and because people accused her of acting like a stereotypical Jew. But what she did is she said, look, I know what all of that sort of abuse is, but everybody who has ever been the other, and we talked earlier about gay people and women and other minorities, she said, I get you and you can get me, because I'll use my own otherness to plug into your otherness. And that is, I think, a rather fascinating thing on which she built her career, because otherness is not something that you ordinarily see in Hollywood stars. You see difference, but you don't see otherness. In fact, most Hollywood stars, particularly before Streisand, it may be less true now, were sort of kind of mainstream American types. And Barbra Streisand, Brooklyn-born, was anything but a mainstream American type. And I also want to say something else that Rich pointed out. You know, Yentl was a film that Barbra Streisand, when she directed that film, as he pointed out, had a very difficult time getting made. No one wanted to make that movie, despite the magnitude of her stardom. They didn't want to make it because they said it's too Jewish and nobody will go to see it. And there's a little irony in that, in that she never intended Yentl to be a musical. She wanted it to be a straight drama. The only way she could get the financing for the film is to agree to turn it into a musical, and the studio felt, you will make no money on this movie. This movie will die. But we will make money on the album because Barbra Streisand will be singing all the songs. And so that's how Yentl became a musical.
And we'll talk more about Yentl as we continue and take more phone calls. Rich, thank you so much for your call. She did study Judaism in the making of that film, and I want to hear more about that. This hour, we're talking about Barbra Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. Neil Gabler, who's written a wonderful book about her, is our guest this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Or go to Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and write your comments about the pretty remarkable, which is a huge understatement, Barbra Streisand.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my fly. I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? I'll march my band out. I'll beat my drum. And if I'm found out, your turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it.
This hour, Barbra Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. Neil Gabler is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. Greg in Madison, hi.
Thanks, Kathleen. I was wondering, Neil, if the book talks at all about how much of a financial success Barbra Streisand is.
Yes, it does. And she is a tremendous financial success, as one can imagine. Although, you know, money was never a driving force. Usually people who grow up in poverty, and she did grow up in poverty, you know, have this kind of, you know, obsession with money. It's just a natural thing. My own father did. Barbra Streisand was not obsessed with money. In fact, she knew very little about the value of money. It was just not something that meant very much to her. But she is tremendously successful. It's difficult to estimate exactly. I've read, you know, varying estimates of how much money she has. Some, you know, range as high as $300 million fortune. She has beautiful homes that she designed and built, had built for her, to her specifications. And in fact, for a long period of time, she sort of absented herself from show business and dedicated most of her time to architecture and decoration. And she once said that if she hadn't become an entertainer, she probably would have become an architect, because she's really fascinated with her own homes. But she is tremendously wealthy. And here's another thing that's sort of interesting. In her later years, she began to dabble in the stock market sort of as a hobby.
Really?
And she became extremely good at it.
Huh.
And in fact, one thing that's said of Barbra Streisand is that she gets up every morning, you know, very early at 6 o'clock to read the ticker from New York to find out what's going on. And Donna Karan once, and she's a very close friend of the clothing designer Donna Karan, said, you know, you're so good with the stock market. Will you invest my money? And Barbra said, no, 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 I can't do that. I can't invest your money. She said, no, please, please, let me give you at least a little bit. She gave Barbara Streisand, and Barbara Streisand multiplied that. I think she made Donna Karen on that one investment alone over $1 million.
Ooh.
So though she's not particularly interested in money, it's become a kind of hobby of hers in her old age.
Interesting. But what's the story? I'm just getting a vague remembrance in the book where she's $64 meant something to her. The millions don't, but it was some story about $64. What is that?
That's right. No, it was she had been her manager had come to her to ask her to give her an offer that had been given to her to do a dog food commercial.
Ah, yes.
Where she would just sing a song about a dog. And and I forget exactly how much money was at stake, but it was significant. It was a lot of money for basically 10 minutes of work.
Right.
You know, somewhere in the $100,000 vicinity. This was early in her career. This was not later in her career. But when she was still, you know, when she was famous. And she said, no, I don't want to do that. But she had bought something and saw that it had gone on sale, and she was absolutely, lathered by the fact that she had spent 64 extra dollars on this item that she'd purchased because of the sale, when she was giving up well over $100,000
right,
for 10
right.
minutes work on a dog food commercial. So, I mean, that's sort of the way that Barbara Streisand thought about money.
Thanks, Greg, very much for your call. Jan on the road. Hi, Jan.
Hi, it's Jan.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
I just wondered if your guest was aware of a record that Barbara Streisand did in the late 50s. I was in my 20s, and I saw her on Johnny Carson, and I was just thrilled. And I went downtown to buy a record to see if I could find one. I'd never heard of her. And so I bought the record, the only record I could find. And it's fabulous. It's the first time she was on Johnny Carson.
Hmm.
Her voice was still untrained, but he could recognize that she really had something. And it also had her singing with her mother, who had a wonderful voice. And on the opposite side of the record was something totally different. It was a large orchestra, and Barbara Streisand sang several songs. I don't remember any of them right now, but her goal was to sound like an instrument, to use her voice as an instrument, and to sound like an instrument, as you don't hear a violin necessarily. You don't necessarily hear flutes. You hear an orchestra, and it's wonderful.
Neil.
Well, that recording that you're talking about is something now of a novelty because Barbara Streisand, when she was quite young, went with her mother to a recording studio, a place where they made records, Steinway Hall in New York on 57th Street, and they went up there and they recorded, she recorded a song and her mother recorded a song that Barbara could then take to various places. And as I say, she was very young at this time. I think she was maybe 12 or 13 years old, maybe 14. Her mother had always been an aspiring singer herself. And in fact, Barbara would say that, you know, she felt that there was a tremendous resentment that her mother felt about Barbara's own success, rather than, as most parents do, enjoying their
sure.
children's success. Her mother felt a certain resentment of the fact that Barbara made it and she hadn't. But I have a feeling that's the record to which you're referring.
Mm.
In terms of Johnny Carson, there's an also interesting story there. She was scheduled to appear on The Tonight Show, but Barbara had tremendous stage fright. And as you may know, there were 13 years where she did not perform publicly
right.
because she had stage fright. And the day that she was to go on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, she just had a crisis and backed out. And Johnny Carson was furious. And he came on that night, and he said, you know, Barbara Streisand backed out. She will never appear on this show again. And, in fact, he introduced a person from the wings whom he introduced as Barbara Streisand. It was a man dressed as Barbara Streisand, just to kind of humiliate her. Now, some of you may know that last year, she appeared for the first time on The Tonight Show since she broke that appearance when Jimmy Fallon had her on for the release of her duets album.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time in nearly 50 years
Isn't that
Barbara Streisand had gone on The Tonight Show, because for all intents and purposes, she had been banned from the show.
Mm. Well, she also did this. Let's talk about the phrase kookiness that's associated with her. When she was interviewed, she had this persona, throwing the legs around, kind of being this, not that's answering right. things in any kind of really intelligent fashion. She's obviously very smart, wearing outfits that we probably, you know, we love. She set a fashion example that people started following from resale shops. But she did. Why did she do that? Why did she purposely want to portray herself as kooky in a way?
I think it was a strategic.
Really?
It wasn't all that different from her own personality, but in those days, in those days I mean, you know, in the early 60s, when talk shows were first gaining popularity, like the Jack Parr Show and others of that ilk, there was a show called PM East and PM West that she appeared on quite frequently. There were guests on those shows who were known as kooks. They were guests who basically were there to be themselves and to say rather silly things and to have the audience laugh at them and to have the host be perplexed as he talked with them. And Barbra Streisand then was in a kind of genre of guest. She was the kook. She, as you point out, she talked in non sequiturs. She wore these resale fashions. She just acted in a kind of bizarre fashion. But, you know, it was strategic in two senses. One sense was that, of course, it gave her attention, and she was a kind of guest that people love to book because you never knew what was going to come out of her mouth. Very different from the Barbra Streisand that we know now.
Mm-hmm.
But the second way in which it was strategic is that, you know, she'd say all these goofy things and act strangely, and then, of course, they'd ask her to sing. And out of this mouth,
right,
which had previously been saying all these nutty things, would come this glorious voice. And it was partly the disjunction
mm-hmm.
between the kook and the beautiful instrument, to use the term that the caller used, that put people, you know, kind of set people back and saying, oh my gosh, this silly girl is an amazing singer. And so the kookiness was kind of a setup for the singing.
Neil Gabler is our guest. He writes about, we've talked about her being Jewish. He writes in the book, she's not religiously Jewish, at least, and Rich brought this up with his call, at least not until she made Yentl, and she studied Judaism for that film. She did have a Jewish sensibility, that sense of being the other, tormented as a girl for her Semitic looks and called Big Beak because of her nose. I wanted to play a little piece from Yentl. This is the song I remember, certainly, from that film, and you can't help but think she's thinking and singing about her father. But I'm also interested in the study of Judaism that went along with this film. So here is Barbara from Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me in the night? Papa, are you near me? Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you help me not be frightened? Looking at the skies, I seem to see a million eyes. Which ones are yours? Where are you now that yesterday has waved goodbye and closed its doors? The night is so much darker.
Papa, can you hear me? Oh, she's got to be singing to her daddy, isn't she?
Oh, she certainly is. You know, as I said, you know, he died when she was 15 months old. It was a deficit that she never got over, I believe, in her entire life. And she referenced it quite a few times in her life. And you know, all of Barbra Streisand's movies, all of them, are personal. In some way, even the comedies, you know, she's working out some of her own personal issues. But in Yentl, clearly one of the issues she's working out is the loss of her father. And her father in the film as well dies early on in the film, which is why she sings that song to him, you know, asking basically for his guidance as she heads out into the wider world. Now, you asked about, you know, her Jewishness. you know, she obviously identifies very closely with being Jewish, and she said that. But she was not a religious Jew. Even though she went to a yeshiva, which is a Jewish school, when she was young, she was more or less a secular Jew.
Mm-hmm.
But when she did make Yentl, it coincided with her son, Jason, taking his bar mitzvah instruction. And Barbara went with Jason to take instruction herself. And, you know, she did become much more religiously Jewish because of that experience. It just parenthetically, the rabbi with whom she studied and who tutored her son as well, later became a very, very right-wing rabbi who turned on Barbara Streisand.
Really?
Politics, as we all know, are very liberal.
Yes.
And couldn't stop attacking her for her politics and for the way he felt that she portrayed Jewishness and Judaism. He was very, very much angered with her for what he felt was indulging Jewish stereotypes.
Mm. And I really loved her political film, The Way We Were. I know it had mixed reviews, but I really enjoyed that film. And there were a lot of things at work in terms of her ethnicity and Robert Redford and going after the gorgeous guy, you know, the blonde hair athlete. It was filled with so much, the Blacklist, all of that.
Oh, Kathleen, that's to me, that's the greatest of her films.
You like that one, too?
For several reasons. And one is that, as you point out, it's the film in which she most draws upon her otherness and what it means.
Yes.
And the blend of Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. Now, she almost always plays against a Gentile leading man. But there, the film is about the relationship between a man who is almost purely aesthetic in Robert Redford and a woman who is almost purely moral in Barbara Streisand. And the way those two parts complement one another, Streisand needs the aesthetic and Redford needs the moral, and the way in which, even though they complement one another, they can't really coexist. And there are so many things in that film, so many lines in that film, I think that go to the heart of Barbara Streisand's appeal, mm-hmm. and Robert Redford's, for that matter. I mean, one I think is absolutely kind of quintessential Barbara Streisand, even though she's not in that scene, is a scene where Robert Redford is talking to his childhood friend, played by Bradford Dillman, his college friend, excuse me, played by Bradford Dillman, who has married one of their college friends, this beautiful girl played by the model, Lois Childs, and he says to Redford, you know, Cece and I are going to get a divorce. And Redford says to him, I'm really sorry to hear that. You know, that's really tough. And Dillman says back to him, well, it's not like losing Katie, who's Barbara Streisand's character. That would really
yes.
be something.
Yeah, I remember that line so well from that movie.
That would really right. be something. And it speaks to how we feel about Barbara Streisand, that she's just not another pretty face. She, you know, there are a million models out there, and there'll always be another one that you can get, but there's only one Barbara Streisand, there's only one Katie. And that Robert Redford recognizes that in the film, and it becomes the basis of their relationship, at the same time that it also becomes the basis of the friction between them, because she demands too much of him. She demands that he be too great, that he be everything he can be. Which is what Barbara Streisand always demands of herself.
Right, right.
And he doesn't want to do that because it just is, it's too hard. Yeah. It takes too much work.
And he was worried about taking the role because he thought it would be, she would be too demanding and it would be all Streisand, the movie, right?
He did. And I think he felt, you know, I'm playing the straight man, basically, to Barbara Streisand. I don't want to do that. I won't take that role. And it was in part because he pushed back. And because he told director Sidney Pollack that the role had to be strengthened, that the movie turned out so well. Because it's not. It is Barbara Streisand's movie in a way. But her position in the film is not always right. What makes the film, I think, work is that when Redford tells her, you're always pushing, all the time, don't you ever give up, he's right.
Right, right.
And when she says to him, you know, I push so hard because I want you to be everything you can be, she's right. And it's rare that you find a movie where both protagonists are right.
We're talking about Barbara Streisand this hour of the program with the author of a great book about her, Barbara Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. And we're welcoming phone calls to 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call or leave a message on our Facebook page as well, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We would love to hear from you. Barbara Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. Neil Gabler is our guest this hour, welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Carol in Oak Creek, hi.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the Academy Awards. She wasn't even nominated for Best Director for Yentl in 1983, which I thought was a travesty. Any ideas on why she was passed over for even a nomination for Yentl?
Carolyn, you raise a very important issue in her relationship to Hollywood, which is they really don't like her very much. And they don't like her, I believe, and she would say the same thing, because she's a woman who didn't know her place. Now, Yentl is a beautifully directed film, and I don't think there's any question about it. And she is a very expert director. But Barbara Streisand, once she became a star, now when she was on the ascendance, you know, critics, you know, were all hailing her, and Hollywood kind of surrounded her and hailed her. But once she had made it, once she had reached the pinnacle, there was the idea that she just didn't know her place anymore. She was becoming impossible. You know, women had to understand their role in the larger film industry, and Barbara Streisand didn't. And when she actually had the temerity to become a director, I mean, there was tremendous hostility to her because it wasn't something that women generally did in Hollywood. And to this day, frankly, there aren't enough women in Hollywood who are directors, though the road was paved by Barbara Streisand. And this whole notion that, you know, she's too much of a perfectionist, and she would say and has said, you know, a man does what I do, he's a perfectionist. If I do it, you know, I'm a diva, or I'm a monster, I'm impossible. And, you know, if you have confidence in your work, you know, for a man, that's confidence. For a woman, it's narcissism. And all of these things, all of these, you know, adjectives were thrown at her. You know, she was a she was narcissistic. She was, you know, impossible. She was, you know, an egomaniac. She was, I mean, everything that you can possibly throw at her has been thrown at her because Hollywood didn't like her very much. And again, I think this has to do with her feminism. mm-hmm. and not with anything else.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that she was at her peak. Well, she's always been at her peak, but that she was living and was an adult during the early years of feminism in this country.
Yes, I think that's important because she becomes a feminist icon and I think helps the feminist movement because it gives the movement someone, a very high-profile figure to whom it can attach. But, of course, she benefits as well. It's reciprocal. She benefits from the movement. And you know, I think there's a way in which they empower one another. And I'm not sure that Barbara Streisand would have been as popular as she became if it weren't for feminism, because that paved her road, even as she was helping pave that road herself.
Mm-hmm. Some little bits of information I didn't know that are in your book, and there are so many of these. JFK, where did he hear her sing? He invited her to sing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Did she do it?
She did. She did. He saw her on television before she had become a big hit. I believe it was on the Dinah Shore Show. And he said, boy, this I want this girl to sing. And in fact, there's a famous story afterwards when he met her, and she was told, you know, don't ask the president for an autograph, you know, be very respectful. Of course, was the first thing that Barbara Streisand said. She asked the president for an autograph,
right?
And I mean, that's Barbara Streisand. And the president says, President Kennedy says, and how long have you been singing? And she says to the president, about as long as you've been president.
That's a great answer. Didn't go to college, self-taught, living in her director's apartment for a while, her director and his wife. Anna Karenina, a book that changed her life. I wanted you to write more about that. How so?
Well, you know, she went through a period where she became self-educated. She didn't go to college. I mean, she was smart. She finished, I believe, third in her class at Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn. And her guidance counselor said, you ought to go to college. Her mother was kind of pushing her in that direction, but she was determined to become an actress. And she actually graduated early from high school and went to Manhattan to take acting lessons and to take a number of menial jobs to support herself and her acting lessons. But at the same time, she was reading voraciously. And in a way, as a kind of legacy, a legacy of her father's. And among those books, I mean, she read Anna Karenina, which, you know, just immediately astonished her and astounded her because, you know, of the identification she had with the lead character. And it was also something that she learned her father had an attachment to. So it formed a kind of generational, cross-generational attachment to the book.
Hmm. She's happy now? Do you think she found, you write about her life now and being able to have a family that's kind of warm, and it was sad in a way to read that she hadn't really had that before. She seems content in her family, her new family, relatively.
I believe that's true. You know, she's married now to the actor James Brolin, and they've been married, you know, since 1998. And as you know, all of her fans know, she's not performing anywhere near as much as she once did. She's barely appears in films. She is going to be on a concert tour next month. But she had once said herself that my entire career was sublimation. And I think it was sublimation for the things that she didn't have in her personal life. Well, she has those things in her personal life now. And I happen to believe, I can only speak from, you know, very much on the outside, that Barbara Streisand has found contentment. Mm-hmm. She seems to be happily married. She seems to be happy with her position in the world. And, you know, it's in a way, she's kind of come full circle from a little girl who lost her father early on, who suffered all of these abuses, who had to work so hard to overcome the obstacles in her way. And now, at the end, she's back with a family, a husband who apparently loves her, mm-hmm. in a situation that is apparently comfortable for her and nurturing for her. And now, she's 74 years old, she's arrived in a personal sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us. You're also just an exquisite writer. It's a lovely book. And thank you so much for being with us, Neil.
Well, Kathleen, I really appreciate your asking me. I appreciate those kind words. Thank you so much.
Yeah, our pleasure. Neil Gabler, the book is Barbra Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. Thanks so much to K.P. Whaley for producing The Hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers and Kiri Salinas for helping to produce The Hour as well. Thanks to Kiri for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again Monday for all things political. But first, this may be one of our more famous.
With one person, one very special person, a feeling deep in your soul. A person who needs